Blog Talk Radio.
It's important for us to understand that the struggle for our liberation is a complete process, brother, and which requires of us to be prepared to address the causes of our oppression.
In the 1970s, as heroin ravaged New York City, political radicals, including members of the Black Panther Party and the Young Lords, pioneered the use of acupuncture to treat addiction. Dr. Mutula Shakur led this movement and founded the first community acupuncture detox clinic in North America. Over a decade later, he was listed among the FBI's 10 most wanted. Montreal-based filmmaker Mia Donovan explored the hidden history of how the Lincoln Detox Program took on the public health care system, big pharma, and the war on drugs. Civil rights hero or enemy of the state, Dr. Shakur has been incarcerated for over 30 years. Dopest Death, the podcast, asks, why is he really still in prison?
Here's my student. I don't know what he did after school. I have no idea what he did after school. I was just a teacher. I'm just a teacher. We are close as far as being pioneers together. You understand?
That's Mariel Wexu. Mariel and his father, Oscar, founded the first acupuncture school in North America back in 1970. It was called the Quebec Institute of Acupuncture, and the courses were only offered in French. In 1974, Mariel received a call from a man named Mutula Shakur. Mutula wanted Mariel to go from Montreal to the South Bronx to teach the Black Panthers and the Young Lords acupuncture to get people off of heroin. Mutula didn't understand French, but was determined to get his doctorate degree so he could be taken seriously and eventually start his own school. Mariel and his father were very outspoken about their disdain for Western medicine. Oscar Wexu regularly called out doctors in the press for performing unnecessary surgeries and prescribing too many drugs. So when Mariel heard about what was happening in the South Bronx, how people were dying at the dilapidated Lincoln Hospital because of insufficient medical care, and in the streets because of widespread heroin addiction, he wanted to help. The Quebec Institute of Acupuncture offered Mutula Shakur and three of his comrades scholarships. And 3 years later, in 1977, Dr. Mutula Shakur became one of the first Black acupuncturists in America.
Mutula's mission was to help people, the Black people, to heal themselves, to heal themselves with their own, by their own means. So the acupuncture was inexpensive, and anybody could learn it. It was that hard to learn, and it didn't cost anything to do, and you could heal people. You have to depend on Western doctors who are abusing the people over there in Harlem and the Bronx. They were being abused completely.
This unexpected partnership between a Romanian Jewish immigrant from Montreal and a radical Black power leader in New York City revolutionized drug addiction treatment. They developed a standardized 5-point ear acupuncture protocol that is still used today around the world.
Breathe in, exhale. Okay, Walter, turn your head that way like you're looking at that hat.
We're at the New York Harm Reduction Educators Clinic in Harlem with Juan Cortez. Juan runs the acupuncture program here at NYRA and has been treating people with acupuncture for 14 years now.
I'm all right, how are you?
Good.
Jones.
The NYRA Clinic is near Lexington and 125th Street, one of the few areas in Harlem that appears untouched by gentrification.
There you go, brother. You don't try not to tense up when you breathe in. Just try to relax. Breathe in. And exhale. All right? All right. Turn your head for me.
Juan doesn't look like your typical acupuncturist. He's wearing a New York Yankees hat, a Nike tracksuit, and spotless white Nike shoes, and seems a lot younger than his 55 years.
We provide different services like auricular acupuncture, Reiki, Tai Chi, aromatherapy, sound therapy, and holistic counseling to people in the community that have been living with HIV, hepatitis, people that are at risk for overdose, people who have a history of incarceration, mostly communities of color, pretty much people that have been disenfranchised and stigmatized. And I've been doing that for 14 years.
There you go.
Very good, man. When you go like this, all your muscles tense up and it'll hurt when I put the needle. When you just go like this, all your muscles are relaxed, so you won't feel it. Okay? There you go, relax, man.
How long have you been doing this?
I've been doing this whole show about 7 or 8 years. Maybe more. Maybe I'll skip coming. I enjoy drugs like this. It helps me a lot of things. It calms my grieving. It calms my heart down. It keeps me relaxed. And it just makes me happy. I'm a happy person anyway, and with this, it made me extra happy. Come on, put the fans in.
That's Lily. The acupuncture that she is getting is called community acupuncture, which means it takes place in a group setting among peers seated on chairs facing each other in a circle. Addiction can be a very alienating experience. Community acupuncture aims to bring people together and remind them that they are not alone.
Okay, sir. 1, 2, 3, 4. Put your head up a little bit. Okay. Breathe in. Exhale. Breathe in. All right, breathe in for me. And exhale. Let's do it together. All right. A lot of the people that come through these doors, a lot of people have been traumatized their whole life. They've been abused physically, some sexually, some emotionally. Their only experience with human contact is one of pain for a lot of people. So when they come through the doors and you're actually connecting with them and you're like, you're having human contact, not to induce pain, but to induce healing. That's very powerful.
This helps me with my anger management. Because, Lily, let me talk. This helped me with my anger management, and I found out through taking anger management courses that it's not anger I feel, it's hurt. So it hurts me manage the hurt that I have within and keeps me off of away from alcohol and, you know, substance.
Right, you have to medicate yourself. I mean, yes. This is your natural medicine here.
Yes, yes, yes.
Come on, hit me up, man. Wait, look up a little bit. There you go.
When I was at the clinic, I witnessed people coming in and looking very agitated, ornery, and restless. Once they were seated, one would insert pins or needles into specific points on the ear to relieve stress, anxiety, and withdrawal symptoms associated with drug use. Imagine the ear like an upside-down human fetus, and the acupuncture points on the ear correspond to the body parts of the fetus shape, with the earlobe representing the head. Within minutes of receiving the needles, their bodies would relax, their eyes brighten, and they would start engaging with those around them. It's a powerful thing to witness.
And greetings. Welcome to another segment of New Day, Resurrection and Liberation. My name is Empress Chi, also known as Dr. Filet, and of course you are in tune to our weekly regular broadcast of New Day. And wow, family, can you believe this year is almost over? Whew, I'm telling you. And you know what? I hate to say it, but going to be some stuff coming. So folks better get ready, because 2023 and the next few years is going to be very, very interesting. And that puts it mildly. We started off tonight, of course, in hearing there was some excerpts from actually a podcast, but the podcast is connected to a documentary. The documentary is, of course, about Dr. Mutula Shakur. It is called Dope is Death. And we're going to talk more about that. We're going to talk more about Dr. Mutula Shakur, the emergency, or shall we say, the alert that's now being placed out to raise funds immediately to expedite his release. Of course, he was granted parole, but Brother Shep conveyed us in a message that, you know, they're holding it up. This system, these people are holding it up. There's monies that have to be indicated before he can be released, meaning Gautam Mutula Shakur. And I will read to you very shortly the statement or the message that Brother Shep sent out, and also give you information on how folks can support. And please, 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 please send this information out to others. Right now, we're going to bring in, I think I see him in queue, I hope that is him in queue, Dr. George Love, who, of course, is one of the many students that came through the school that Dr. Mutula Shakur started in the system, shall I say. He created a very unique system of acupuncture. That's why we wanted to start it tonight's program off, because what MWM will be doing in the months to come, there's three areas that we're going to be focusing on in creating and developing independent institutions in that regard: education, health, and finance. Those are the three areas that we are focusing on developing independent institutions. And with that said, you're going to hear more about that tonight and also in upcoming programs. But again, I'm looking for Dr. George Love. Dr. Love, if you are there, you need to press 1 so that I can see that you are in queue. And we are going to talk again about the great work of Dr. Mutula Shakur. Again, Dr. Love is one who has agreed to work with us. We were trying to bring him in for the kickoff for the Million Women March reunion. Unfortunately, we decided to wait until we could really focus on, having him with us to really focus on health. And there was so much going on with the reunion kickoff that, you know, we didn't want folks to get distracted, or, you know, we didn't want too much going on at one time. So we're going to wait and give folks plenty of time to register, because we're going to really do courses that are for your basic general upliftment and self-awareness and wellness, self-care, that's the word I was looking for, but also those who are interested in literally becoming practitioners. I'm going to tell you more about that shortly. Let's go to our live line. I do see Dr. Love in queue. And again, we want to thank him for taking the time to join us. And greetings, Dr. Love. We got you now. How are you this evening?
Greetings, Empress Chi. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Yes, you also, my brother. Thank you for taking the time to join us. I guess you heard a little bit of what we started off with tonight, some of the excerpts from the documentary, Dope is Death. And, of course, it focuses on the work of Dr. Mutula Shakur. And you, of course, are one of the people who, you know, can pretty much, you know, just tell us from your own experiences how invaluable, how incredible Dr. Mutula Shakur's work is, what it has meant, how it has impacted so many lives. Dr. Love, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, there was a group of Black and Puerto Rican activists in New York called the Young Lords in New York City, in the South Bronx to be specific, and they took over the nurses' wing of Lincoln Hospital, and that caused a big uproar, and they wanted to speak directly to the mayor. The mayor agreed to meet with them, and they accused the mayor of not caring about the city of South Bronx and how heroin addiction had blighted whole neighborhoods in the South Bronx. So the mayor said, well, what is it that you actually want? And they said, we want a health center to fight this addiction. So he agreed. He said, but I'm only going to give you 1 year. You have to donate your time for 1 year before we put you on the payroll. And they agreed to do. Shortly after they opened the first clinic, that was in 1978, the New York Health and Hospitals opened up a methadone clinic around the corner. So the young lords went around the corner to smash in the windows of this methadone clinic, and it was caught on film. And Tulu Shakur, excuse me, was then fired from Lincoln Hospital. And so he opened up Black Acupuncture Association of North America on 145th Street in Harlem. Now, I started acupuncture school in 1979 in Montreal, the school that he had just, excuse me, school he had just graduated from 2 years earlier. So I finished school in 1991. So I come to New York, and I find out that Tulu Shakur is under FBI. They want to arrest him for some bank robbery that happened in upstate New York that he had absolutely nothing to do with. In fact, there were two white terrorists who were killed in the shootout, but they had Tulu Shakur's phone number in their pocket. So the FBI put two and two together and accused him of masterminding this bank robbery. And so they invaded Black Acupuncture Association in North America, kicked the doors in, took all the equipment, took all the patient files, and arrested all the brothers that were doing acupuncture at BANA. And then here I come into Lincoln Hospital, where I just got hired after graduating, thinking I'm the first Black acupuncturist in New York. And one by one, all these brothers come out of the woodwork to tell me what had happened with Tulu and all the things that he had created in Harlem, and that the federal government, or the, not the federal government, the local government did not want to give health services to Black and Puerto Rican immigrants in New York City, and they wanted to deny us health care access. And they wanted this drug addiction to take us out of circulation. This was all a political design. And here Tulu owns to the system, of course, with the young lords, not by himself, but he's part of this organization, the leader of this organization that against the local state government, and you can look this up, you can Google any of this information if you want. And so we were able to fight against New York State, New York local political action to create this healthcare system. Now, I come on the scene in 1981, just 5 years after Tulu's been taken out of circulation. And they come to me and say point blank, the FBI is going to come to you. The FBI is going to arrest you for practicing medicine without a license. And I said, well, they're going to have to step to me. I have a degree in radio, television, and film from Temple University in Philadelphia. They're just going to have to come after me. And for some miracle of miracles, they never came after me. And I was able to promote acupuncture as a medical benefit for our community on both Manhattan Cable Television and WNWK Radio in New York. And the rest, as they say, is history. I was a student of both Mario and Oscar Wexu, and earned my degree in acupuncture from them, and then went on to get my doctorate in Chinese medicine later. So this was the fact that Black folks are alive is a very act of rebellion, because they were trying to kill us.
Wow. You know, it never ceases to amaze me. And family, you're hearing some of the other, not that it hasn't been told, but to hear, you know, this coming from Dr. George Love, who literally, you know, went through this experience. This is why we always try to bring you people who, you know, those are the ones. I mean, they can tell you these things. This is not just a conversation with people. These are the actual people. It's very important that we're able to bring you, the direct kinds of sources and information. We feel really blessed to be able to do that. And also blessed to be able to continue some of the great legacies of some of the people that we talk about. We don't want to just talk about our people in the context of what great work they've done and so forth and so on. We want to make sure that we continue to support them, and that's part of what this conversation is also about, but also make certain that we further continue the work, because this is so important. I mean, we talk about these things, but what are we talking about doing that is going to continue to work? And big shout out to our New York family. I love what they're doing there. Our brother Ray Ray, of course, with the NACI Black History Study Group. They had another wonderful session this past week. And, of course, Sister Keisha. There are many brothers and sisters doing incredible. And unfortunately, we got to do even more because this beast, man, they got some stuff coming. But anyway, let's go back to Dr. George Love. So, Dr. Love, tell me, first of all, give me a chance to pull up. I want to read a statement from Brother Shep. And, of course, Brother Chep is an original veteran Black Panther Party member who is, you know, you got some folks that talk about what they did back in the day when they was in this and in that. But then when you look at, well, what the hell are you doing now? A lot of times it's like, you know, very disappointing. But with Brother Shep, that is not the case. He is definitely one who has continued to do the work. So let me read a brief statement from him, Dr. Love, and then you can comment. Brother Shep says, if the actual funds to both support his parole, talking about Dr. Matula Shakur, his transition, and to safely bring Dr. Matula Shakur home via medical transport are not raised, then his release date will be pushed back and he will be forced to stay in prison until they are. There are no pensions, 401k retirement plans, or stock options for our freedom fighters when they finally come home from political imprisonment. Only the power of the people that fought so hard over the past 39 years to win and return him home, Dr. Matula, to his family, friends, and his beloved Black New African community can help provide the life-sustaining support and comfort he needs. Free them all, Brother Shep. And, of course, Brother Shep is with the NFSF organization. He's one of the operation and research coordinators. So with that said, family, you just heard it. They are not going to let Matula Shakur out until there is X amount of funds visibly available to transport him medically, and also to show indication that medical care can be sustained. Dr. Love, you know, when I mentioned this to you earlier, you was like, what? But, you know, I mean, this is what these people do. But, you know, but let's talk a little more about that. And before you do, I just want to remind everyone, December 10th, we will be in front of the United Nations headquarters it is a informal, but it'll be on the record because we are inviting the press. We don't expect many press, but that's okay. We're going to do it live stream on Facebook and whatever other way we can. December 10th, we'll be at the United Nations, and that will be a people's indictment of COINTELPRO, amongst other things. But we have to put on record, and I mean, it is on record, but again, when we talk about the release of our political prisoners, which right now we are heightening those campaigns, Mumia's next court date is December the 16th. International Human Rights Day is December the 10th. So we will be coordinating with folks in France and in other countries for December 10th to make sure that whatever pressure we can put on for Mumia going back to court on December 16th, we want to be able to do that. So again, on December 10th, we'll do a solidarity rally, a people's indictment of COINTELPRO to free all our political prisoners, and also we'll be focusing on some of the other issues. So I'll come back to that later. Let's go back to Dr. Love. Dr. Love, you heard the statement from our brother, Brother Shep. And with that, you know, again, there's an appeal for support of Dr. Matulu. I'm going to later give folks the information as to, you know, how they can use PayPal or whatever. But going back to you, Dr. Love, what are your thoughts about that?
I'm just looking up on the Internet that the Justice Department awards more than $110 million for formerly incarcerated individuals' re-entry into society program. And I just sent you that link.
Okay, thank you.
And now I'm looking up families, medical parole, New York provides compassionate release to eligible incarcerated individuals with terminal illness and debilitating medical conditions through its medical parole program. Now, this is not New York State. It has to be New York State because he committed.
Well, he's not in New York. And he's going to, if I'm not, I mean, not that it matters because it's the Justice Department or at least some of that, and so that would be federal. But I believe he will be going to California, and he's not. And where is he actually in prison? I got to go back to that. But I hear what you're saying, and a lot of times those types of things are in other states as well. But Dr. Love, please continue.
Okay, so there's Families Against Mandatory Minimums. Have an organization. This is, again, this is New York State. I'm trying to find the federal. Medical parole, compassionate release. Prison law office, compassionate release, medical parole. Nothing about the person having to have funds in order to be released. Nothing.
Right. It's just asinine at best. So certainly we know that this is intentional. We've never heard of this before, because remember, there are two other political prisoners who were released. Sundi Adeakoli was also ill, and to my knowledge, that demand was not placed on him, right? We strongly believe that one of the reasons why Dr. Matulu Shakur has been treated the way that he has, meaning when I went back to look further, it was at least 10 times that he was turned down for parole. Once he became eligible, it was 10 times that he was turned down. And so it's pretty much believed that one of the reasons why that has happened with him is because of the connection to our sister Asada Shakur, and the fact that never before in history, at least not recorded history that we know of, has anyone gone inside of a prison and brought somebody out? And so they have linked him to that. And of
okay, course, we can contact Vice President Kamala Harris directly. U.S. Department of Labor announces availability of $55 million in grants to provide pre-release funds. Biden announces reentry program. The money is there. There is available money. So this is a temporary roadblock. Finance for formerly incarcerated people. Grant money for released prisoners. Grants, loans, grants. I mean, the money is there. This is an artificial barrier, and this is bogus, preventing him from being released from prison. Grant money for released prisoners. Second chance, community-based reentry. I mean, it's there. All the information is there. And
I hear what you're saying.
Smart lawyer. If all this money, if $55 million, what is it that they need?
Right.
They need $50,000. They need a truck. They need a trailer. This is all artificial barrier stuff to prevent him from being released. And we have to find somebody to go over the Justice Department, and that would be Kamala Harris. So we'd have to find somebody to make a personal appeal to get to her, so he could get out of there.
Yes.
Grant for felons, free government money, free money for ex-felons, grant money for released prisoners, grant money for released prisoners. I mean, it's so much information here. It's unbelievable.
Okay. Well, I definitely want to look at that further and, you know, bring that to the attention of some of the folks that are dealing directly with the case, with the release. I did speak with Dr. Mutulu's son earlier. And so, you know, I will, when I get a chance to speak with him again, I will definitely bring that to his attention and a few others. But I really appreciate you looking that up because I wasn't aware of any of that. Dr. Love, I want you to stay right there, if you would, please. I'm going to come back to you. I want to bring in Sister Nefa for a few moments because I did ask her to call in. She has an event for tomorrow, and I wanted to make sure that we put that information out. I'm going to be sending the posting out, family, for those who are in the Philadelphia tri-state area. I'll be sending out a posting in a few minutes for an activity that's coming up tomorrow. It is National Head Wrap Day. Now, we're going to just do a little sidebar here. I want to give Dr. Love a few more moments to maybe check out some other information. I'm going to come back to him. But I'm going to also connect the dots here. Now, we're talking about political prisoners. We're talking about health. But at the same time, we're talking about community involvement. This is what Dr. Mutulu Shakur was about. And one of the things I've been talking to Sister Nefa about is us making certain she's going to be working with us to, in terms of some of the women's programs, but also work with some of the young daughters, some of the young girls. And one of the things that we're going to be doing with our young sisters and our older ones too is things dealing with health. And again, for personal purposes as well as for family and community purposes. And so one of the locations that Sister Nefa is affiliated with, and Dr. Love, this is probably where we're going to be bringing you when you do come to Philly. But we're going to be talking a little more about doing some stuff online in the meantime. But again, Dr. Love, I'm going to give you a few more moments to kind of research some things. And I'm going to go to Sister Nefa and just talk a little bit about the program that she has tomorrow. She did a wonderful presentation for us for a Million Woman March reunion launching for head wrapping. And again, these are some of the things that we're now bringing forward into our communities, knowing our culture, knowing what is applicable to us in terms of health, And by the way, Sister Neff is going to be a part of our Speakers Bureau along with Dr. Love. We're getting ready to launch that for February, family. So if you need speakers for health, for culture, for arts, we have it now. So we'll tell you more about that shortly as well. But starting for Black History Month, you'll be able to connect to what we call the M4 group. M, the letter M, capital M, and the number 4, the M4 group. And it stands for media, marketing, merchandising, and manufacturing. It may end up being the M5 because we're getting on the music too, but for now it's M4. But anyway, let's go talk to Sister Neffa real quick, and then we're going to come back to Dr. George Love and talk more about Dr. Matula Shakur. Hey, Sister Neffa, how are you this evening?
Hey, Flay. Dr. Tune Sue, how are you? Peace and blessings. Thanks for having me.
Oh, always, my sister, always. So you have another event coming up tomorrow.
I sure do. So tomorrow is National Head Wrap Day. It's been in the books for the last 6 years or so, maybe a little bit longer, celebrating head wrapping, the art of it, the culture of it from the African diaspora. And so
yes,
tomorrow from 2 to 6, we are having a celebration in honor of that over at I&I at 1439 North 52nd Street in West Philly. And it is going to consist of a panel discussion, kind of bridging the gap from the generations. So we're going to have Mama Atiola, Sister Sahara, representing their legendary mood hats from the 1970s, mm-hmm. which they mm-hmm. call mood hats, but they're head wraps. And then we're going to have a couple of artisans, raptologists, and rap stars on the panel discussion just talking about head wrapping and the art of it and the culture of it, the history of it. After that, we're going to be doing a demonstration, head wrap demonstrations, as well as a mini fashion show. We also have the privilege of having an artisan, Tutwa Nier. She's a quilter who does these amazing head wrap quilts, African beads quilts. So she has an installation she just put up today. It's going to be there throughout the rest of the 2022 year, but she will be featuring it tomorrow as well. So we're looking forward to sharing a bit of the information and just showing how we can adorn ourselves.
No doubt, no doubt. And family, if you've ever seen Sister Neffa, let me tell you, oh my gosh, it is such a beautiful thing to see when our sisters wrap their head. And I'm telling you, Sister Neffa has really just, the skill and the art of it all, she has just been able to just capture so much of that. Sister Neffa, don't you have a DVD available as well?
Actually, we do not. We had one, but it's a little outdated. So actually tomorrow we are going to be filming to create a new one, a revised one. So, and
great.
Hopefully if you're not doing anything, you'll be in the space. I'd love to have you there. You know, you're my inspiration.
People don't know. I used to wrap my head every single day.
You sure
day.
Did. And you taught me how to. So, you know, much, much respect for that.
Oh, good thanks, good thanks. So tell us again tomorrow. Now, by any chance, is it going to be live stream?
So we are working on that. We haven't advertised it as such, but if we can surprise some folks that way, then we sure will.
Okay. Yeah, because a lot of our folks really are not, you know, from Philly. Philly is such a, anyway.
I know, we got to do better with that.
And we're going to, that's why I stay in Philly, because I'm committed to making sure that it does, because, like, you know, our people work too hard in this city to bring, you know, to bring a certain high energy to the city, to have these Negropeans to just block and knock and all of that. So so we're going to make it happen. You believe that. Our ancestors are demanding it.
Absolutely.
So tell us again the time and the location.
Yep, it's from 2 to 6 tomorrow, November 20th, at 1439 North 52nd Street. It's called I&I Collective.
Mm-hmm. Okay, wonderful. and those who was with us for our first Black Family Unity Community Day. That's the location that we held it at, by the way. And so, hey, yep, sure was. So you see, we're connecting with our folks that are doing positive things in the community, and we're going to continue to build. Because you know we're going to bring forward this United Black Front anyway, so that we can get this stuff done in a more collective manner. And you know, and again, you know, take some clear political stances, because there should be more Black folks fighting to bring Mumia home, you know? And so we want to make sure that we help to be a catalyst for that. But my sister, I thank you as usual. I am going to stop through. I do have tomorrow we're now doing our national Zoom meetings for the Million Woman World March. It's coming for 2023. So I do have to do that call. But after that, I'm planning on stopping by. Yep.
We'd love to see you there.
No doubt.
Thanks for having me, as always.
Wait a minute. One other thing. Give out your website.
So for the collective, it's I and I. It's the letter I, the letter N like Nancy, the letter I, collective.com. And then for my website, it's simplynefah.com, simplynetfah.com.
All right. Just thanks.
And you can find us on Instagram as well.
All right. Y'all need to go check it out because you will see some beautiful stuff. And she has a shop filled with wonderful wares, accessories, and all kinds of cool things. So,
it's a collective artist in the space. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely. All right, my dear. Thank you again, and I will see you tomorrow.
All right. Peace.
Peace to you. All right, family. So we're going to go back to Dr. George Love, and we were talking about Dr. Matula Shakur, of course. And before going back to Dr. Love, I just want to give you, and I'm going to repeat this a couple of times, and that is what you can do to help. I'm going to definitely take Dr. Love's suggestion in terms of looking up or looking further into some of these funds that are available. I mean, I have no faith in this system, needless to say, but, you know, we got to try and do everything we possibly can. That's just the bottom line. It's not about what we like or don't like or what we believe or don't believe. We have to, no stone should be unturned when it comes to this brother. So with that said, I'm going to be, you know, looking at that further. In the meantime, you can, hold on, let me pull up the PayPal information and also the website information. You can just go to MatulaShakur.com. Again, MatulaShakur.com. And of course, there's an abundant amount of information there. Let's see. Hold on, let me get the PayPal piece here. Okay, this is just a link that I have here for PayPal. So you need to go to the website. So that's MatulaShakur.com. The link is there for the PayPal. Okay. Let's see. Thank you. Use the donation box. Okay, use the donation box there. And apparently that's the best way. They want people to come to the website, which is cool, makes sense to me. Okay, so again, go to www.matulushakur.com. And if you're not sure how to spell that, I will spell it for you. Ready? Okay. So it's MUTULUSHAKUR.com. And I'll repeat it again a little later on because I want to make sure everyone gets it. And we will be sending it out on Facebook and email and encourage you all, please, you know, folks, if nothing else, send it out through your Facebook networks. Okay? I mean, that only will take you a few minutes to do that. Please send the information out to your Facebook or Instagram or wherever it is. Okay, let's go back to Dr. Love. Again, here we are in 2023, and here we are talking about Dr. Matula Shakur, who has served 38 years, by the way, family. But remember, just to show you how advanced some of our people really are. And I was talking to Sister Keisha about this the other day. She was texting me and talking about, you know, some of the youth, some of the young folks, that they're just not, you know, tolerating this nonsense anymore. And I'm like, yeah. I said, but, you know, for me, really, as I examine, this happens every 20 or so years anyway. Because look at the Black Panther Party. During that time period, they was like, we ain't taking this stuff. And they did something about it. And so with that said, Dr. Matulu kind of came from that era whereby they did stuff. I mean, literally, like setting up clinics, setting up schools, feeding people every day, things of that nature. You see, that's real stuff right there. And so we have to, you know, realize and examine what our people have done, have been doing, and particularly we can see very clearly during a time period when we did not have the kind of accessibility that we now have. Our folks was kicking it for sure. So to now talk about Dr. Matula Shakur, we had a drug epidemic of heroin at that point in time, and to be able to come up with a plan of action to address it and to fight to be able to treat our people in a way that would, you know, get them off of that you know, of that monster. Well, what are we talking about doing today, y'all? Because right now we know that there's an epidemic going on. It seems to be mostly amongst white folks. But if y'all don't think they get ready to do something in the Black community, if y'all don't think that's not going to happen soon, then y'all don't understand white supremacy, or the system, rather, of white supremacy. Because best believe, after folks got the jab, oh, they got something else coming. You can believe that. And with the new laws that's going to be put out there allowing, you know, for weed, for marijuana, you think they're just going to put some real stuff out there and not some manufactured stuff or some lace stuff? Anyway, let's go back to Dr. Love. And, Dr. Love, obviously, Dr. Matula was way ahead of his time, way ahead of his time. You know, to have someone who literally, you know, not only took the time to learn something that at that time, you know, very few were doing, but then to do it in such a way to develop a clinic and then to start training others. And tell us a little bit about, you know, there's still an association right now in existence, I believe in New York. Tell us a little bit about that, Dr. Love.
I don't even know where to start. There's a woman, Dr. Oriawana Trinidad. Her husband was part of the original group that had been targeted by the FBI. She continued to teach in Spanish Harlem. I wish I could remember the church, but there's a church that held space for us to teach and to perform acupuncture when the VANA organization was shut down. I found out about her after I started promoting my acupuncture clinic on 125th Street and Lenox in Harlem, which is where the documentary took place. I mean, literally right around the corner. So Dr. Trinidad talked, she's the one who told me exactly how BANA was set up and the fact that they had multi rooms, multi offices, and how they fed people. They dealt with abused women, abused children, women whose husbands had been incarcerated. I mean, it was a real community service organization that they had created. And so I'm just stunned at the amount of work that went in to help our people who did not have access. And we're here sitting on our duffs because the laws have changed, because political process has changed. And it's okay for us to go and do these things. And we're like, well, why couldn't they do that before? Because there were laws against it.
Right.
So we take for granted certain things that 20, 30 years ago were not accessible to us. And we cannot take these things for granted. And we have to fight, and we have to put money, and we have to hire lawyers, and we have to be engaged in the political process, and we have to vote. We have to vote in local elections. All this is very, very, very important for us to do.
And I want to just do a sidebar with what you just said, Dr. Love, and that is, and I think I heard you say this, local elections. I think that's really, really important because, you know, there are some things that can happen in our communities. I have no, you know, faith in that other stuff, that national stuff with the Electoral College and all. But on the local levels, yeah. But here is something. I got a message earlier from one of my brothers in Chicago, and he sent me an article with them talking about the millennials, how they came out, you know, for this last election in their city in Chicago. And I said, yeah, that's cool. You know, that's good. And he was saying how, you know, the millennials are saying that they fed up. They you know, they're really sick and tired of the status quo and all that. I said, yeah, it sounds familiar. All you got to do is study the Black Panther Party and the Black Liberation Army and the Republic of New Africa and a few other groups, because they said the same thing over these past 50 years. But here's where it gets tricky. If you can't, if you don't have a mechanism to keep people accountable, or to make sure that they don't go astray, or to be able to enact a form of punishment, then let me tell you what happened, because this is what happened before with folks. They got in office, and a lot of them flipped the script and became just as detrimental as, you know, the regular people, right, with a few exceptions. So my point is, unless you have an apparatus that can keep people focused and doing what they need to do for us, they end up servicing the system of white supremacy. I mean, it's just the way it is. I see it here in Philly. I'm sure most see it in their cities. You have all of these people that look like us on city council and other offices in your city. But then when you ask, what do they do for the Black community in particular, not just what do they do based on their job, what do they do for Black folks? Because other groups of peoples who, other races that are holding these office, they do their basic job, but you best believe they're looking out for their folks. Yes, they are. Intentionally, deliberately. Okay, so again, yes, we need to vote, particularly on local level kind of interaction. And with that, though, not just vote, Dr. Love, but we need to run our own candidates. Because you've got to remember, even though people vote, where them candidates come from? Who got them candidates? Where they come from?
Exactly. Yeah, it takes
See,
a certain
that's
amount
the other
of
thing. That's the other thing. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a little more complex than just that. And again, in this thing and age, we have to be a bit more intelligent and also again a bit more intentional. Ask questions. We're telling people for the next time around, ask folks, what's your position on reparations? If they're running for a public office, they need to be answering that question. If they want some folks' votes, they need to be answering that question. And folks need to make sure that they get them answers and not just vote for people because they got a cute face, they got a nice smile, they talk a lot of yang-yang. What's your position on certain areas of politics? What's your position? You know? We need to be asking these questions now. So, and let's not even talk about the 2024 jam that's coming up. That's a whole other thing. But anyway, let's go to our live line. Family, if you have a question or a comment from me or for Dr. Love, or you just want to, you know, share some information relevant to some of the things that we've been talking about tonight, by all means, press 1 now. And we would love to hear from you. And also remember that with the We Charge Genocide 21, we're not just talking about reparations. We're talking about human rights violations and at least 21 areas of it. And we're also raising the question around the 13th Amendment, around the prison industrialized complex, which of course got folks working, slave labor, which is connected to the 13th Amendment because, oh, slavery is legal under the 13th Amendment. And y'all do know there's a few states that did have it on their ballot. And when we talked to our Dr. Carlita Atwater a few weeks back, her state, Tennessee, was one of the states that, guess what? They voted to keep slavery or in their thing. I mean, you know, unbelievable, but it's true. I think it was Louisiana also. Anyway, family, if you have a question, comment, thought, press 1 now. We'd love to hear from you. In the meantime, Dr. Love, didn't you just come from, where'd you come from? One of the islands recently? How was that?
Barbados is the island that rejected their membership in the British Commonwealth.
Yes. Yes. I know that's like, woo, that's got to be a good feeling.
Yeah, there's so much, you know, we need to break that down. We need to digest that whole British Commonwealth thing. And what that means, and we need to break down what is the term African American, and how relates to people in the Caribbean. We are not African American. We are American Africans, and America legally includes the Caribbean, because the first two places Columbus landed was in the Caribbean. And we need to remember that, okay? North America technically is the U.S. and Canada, but Northern America includes Mexico, Central America, and the entire Caribbean. Latin America, I just learned, includes Creole-speaking people. Hispanic America means Spanish only. But Latin includes French-speaking, Brazilian or Portuguese-speaking, and all of the Creole languages. That's what Latin America refers to. So if we are not African Americans, but American Africans, they cannot separate us from the Caribbean. So there's a lot to unpack there, and we need to be specific in our language. We are American Africans.
Wow. So, Dr. Love, I want you to make sure, because we're going to be doing from December the 7th through the 9th, we're going to be doing sessions virtually, and one of the sessions, at least one of the sessions, is going to be focusing on what we call pre-plebiscite dialogue, so that our folks can get a little more in tune and acclimated to the ideas and concepts of plebiscite, what it is. And one of the questions that is going to begin circulating is, what should we call ourselves? Because ain't no way in the world we should let other people define who we are. We need
exactly
a discussion and decision about that.
Right.
So to start it off, we're just going to have the conversations about what should we call ourselves, an intelligent intelligent dialogue that people are allowed to say, well, listen, I think it should be this, or I think it should be that, based on this, and this, you know, not just any emotionalism, but based on, you know, here's an evaluation with some thought, critique, et cetera. And then at some point, there's literally going to be a vote so that we can at least temporarily be in sync, you know, to something, so that when we proceed, people will know, oh, is those folks right there? There's some serious folk right there. Okay. We have to do that. But anyway,
right,
we have someone that has a question or a comment for us, so we're going to go to caller at 9498. Caller at 9498. Your mic is open. Welcome to the segment of New Day.
Oh, hello, Sister Filet. How you doing?
Hey, Brother Ray Ray. How are you? Wonderful, wonderful lecture the other evening.
Oh, thank you. It's family. You can view the lecture of Dr. Mendelsohn, part 1 and 2, on YouTube, Brooklyn, BK, William Mackey Jr.'s History Club, and all the lectures will come up where you can see. So hope they just throw another roadblock from Atula Shakur. As far as dealing with Kamala Harris, oh boy. With her crime bill, that's a whole nother, I hope victory comes, and when you do get him out, and when he comes out, you got to pump him full of nutrition, juices, fresh water, lots of vitamins to, you know, build them back up.
Yeah, no doubt, my brother.
Yeah, you know, that's going to be a whole nother struggle, you know, when he comes out, because he will come out. They just throwing these roadblocks and this and that, and nutrients, juices, minerals, fresh water, you know, so if you build his body back up, you know.
That's
going to have to be a 24-hour-a-day, you know, involvement. So the fight is on. Struggle continues, you know. So, you know.
Yes, indeed.
Just keep fighting
yes,
on.
Indeed.
So, Sister Filet, you're doing a good job. We're just trying our best because a lot of stuff is happening. It's just bam, 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 just throwing all kind of stuff, and you don't know what's going on. But we keep continuing and hope for the best. So thank you very much, family. All right, Sister Filet, thank you.
Thank you, my brother. Yeah, it's always something, family, always something, and it's going to always be something. I didn't mention, and I'm going to save it probably for next week so that maybe I can get either Sister Janet or Janine on, but there was a recent article that came out this week, and now there is, I had no idea that the tombstone or the location where the bodies from the you know, from the bombing, from 85 bombing of the Moo family, I did not know that the grave sites were unmarked all this time. Unmarked. Now there's also a question around who's in them, for real. You know, because that was not really done. It's only until recent that there's been any kind of focus or question or whatever about the remains. And that came about accidentally when they realized that the children, some of the children's remains were being utilized for study and research at the University of Penn and I think Princeton. That just happened, you know, in the past year or so. And so the remains were returned back to the family, but for all this time, they've been the possession of the university. Dr. Love, did you know that?
I did not know that.
Yep. Yeah, there was a big stink here in Philly about that. The person had to resign, who is the head over whatever that department is, because that was the person who allowed for the remains to go to the university. And the university, of course, the students at University of Penn, they had a demonstration. This was before they released the remains to the family because it was in the possession of the university all this time, since 1985.
Wow.
They did not give the family the dignity of them being able to bury their loved ones. They kept the remains and then used it for study.
That's
crazy. This was even online. Dr. Love, this was even online. Because they were doing classes during COVID, you know, virtually. And that's how this stuff got found out. Because they literally let people know that this was one of the children remains from the Moon bombing.
I am absolutely.
Folks better realize these people. What makes folks think from the 1600s or the 1500s or whatever, what makes people think that that fundamental mentality and spirit has changed to any degree of, you know, where it's really going to, like, you know, make a difference? You know, there's always one or two or whatever, but overall, for the most part, nah. Mm-mm. And we keep, you know, wanting to hallucinate and think that, oh, you know, we need to turn the other cheek, or we need to forgive, or, okay. See? So it is what it is, Dr. Love. We need to do what we need to do. And again, for those who believe in the ideals and the philosophy and the movements or whatever you want to call it about reparations, along with that, it better be some land. I tell you that, it better be some land. At least on our end, that's what we're looking at. You know, I mean, the money part is cool, but hey, we want some land. Now you're talking. That's real. They call it real estate. Well, it's real stuff for us. Some land. See? And there's plenty of that. We know it. So these are some of the things that we've got to strive for now. All right, family, listen. Before we get ready to close out, is there any other questions or comments? We're going to use the last half an hour to share with you a speech by the great Kwame Ture. It is so appropriate for today. When you hear some of the sections of this speech, you're just going to go, wait a minute, what year is this that this happened? I mean, and it's 1967. When you hear it, you're going to think it was like 2022, because he's saying the same things then that people are saying now. But what part of that are we not understanding? Are we not getting? And so, again, I'm saying, one, we're not talking about our own schools. We're not talking about our own health facilities. We're not talking about our own independent institutions. And if that's not a part of the plan, then, hey, see ya and don't want to be ya. Anyway, let me see if there's any more questions or comments from anyone. If so, you can press one now, and we would certainly love to hear from you. Whew, in the meantime, okay, I want to go to, I think this might be Brother Adrian, but I'm not sure, but let me just check. Caller, you are at 2274. Your mic is open. Welcome to the segment of New Day.
Empathy Hotel.
Hey, brother, I thought that was you, Brother Adrian. How you been?
I'm better than great, and also greetings to your guest, Dr. Law.
Yes, yes. Oh, you know what? We might have lost him. I'm not sure if his connection, but yeah, he should be calling back in. I think he his call dropped. He should be calling back in shortly. But yeah, we would love to bring Dr. Love to Baton Rouge. And also, were you on when I played some of the excerpts from the documentary, Dope is Death?
No, I wasn't able, but I plan on seeing and pulling up that documentary. You know, I'm helping clean the house right now. But just wanted to mention that when you was talking earlier about some of the things that the Black Panthers have been in several conversations with the co-founder of the Black Panthers, Mr. Bobby Seale, who turned 86 a couple of weeks ago. And I just wanted to mention that the Black Panthers, even though they had a legal right to carry guns, they did tutorial programs and as well as securing children who went to school. So children who went to Oakland Public Schools who were being bullied, the Black Panthers used to secure them. And this is why the FBI, under the guise of Robin Carter, J. Edgar Hoover, was moving in to destroy the Black Panthers, because they not only wanted to do community services and had 22 social programs, ambulance programs, sickle cell anemia, and several other programs, but they were also trying to get us to build our own provisional government, where through the court system, we would have a jury of our own peers, so we would be able to have court cases among each other, as well as on the media and things of that nature. So we got to keep those legacies alive. So therefore, that's why I'm adamant about Black people stopping murdering each other, so we can have the ability to be able to organize. One of the main reasons that the FBI moved in on Fred Hampton Sr. is because he was calling truces between the gangs, the L. Rookins and the Stone Mountain Rangers. When he was bringing them together and getting those street gangs to think about building a nation, that's where the problem started for this system of white supremacy.
Oh, I say, my brother. All right. Well, you know, again, these are some of the conversations and really research pieces that we're now looking at, breaking this stuff down so we can clearly see what has happened, how it has happened, so that we know a little more about how we need to proceed in the future. Again, we talk about COINTELPRO. We talk about the targeting of our people, and of course we know that this was something that was going on way before the 60s. I mean, it goes back as far as Yellow Marcus Garvey, but it didn't get an actual name that we can reference until 1950s, 1960s with COINTELPRO. And that's why today we're making sure that that phrase, that concept is a well-known, understood one when it comes to the destruction of black folks. Listen, Brother Adrian, while I'm thinking about it, you sent me something, and family, if y'all don't know this, you need to know it, because I didn't. That's why I love our network. I love our extended family, because they be doing dynamite research. You know, like we said earlier with Brother Ray Ray and what they're bringing with the lecture series, and Sister Keisha's just crazy with her research. but listen, Brother Adrian sent me an article earlier. I want to share this with you, Brother Adrian. You know, we're not going to go into a lot of conversation tonight about Kanye and Kyrie, even though I got a big surprise for y'all when it comes to Kyrie. Oh, when I tell you about that next week, though. But anyway, tell us about the article that you sent me a little while ago. I just find it so amazing.
That Shaquille O'Neal, who was one of the ones, him and Charles Barkley, when they called Kyrie Irving an idiot, that Shaquille O'Neal, one of the theaters that he owned, is showing the movie Hebrews to Negroes, the same movie that is under so much strife and controversy for some reason by many people who probably have never seen it, never even seen the trailer, but saying it's anti-Semitic, although Kyrie Irving, all he did was post a movie. He didn't say if people should go see it or not. He just posted it on his Instagram and said, here it is. But Shaquille O'Neal has a theater that is showing the movie From Hebrews to Negroes. While he's calling, disagreeing with the movie, his theater is showing. And this is ironic. It says, Shaquille O'Neal's theater showed Kyrie Irving's anti-Semitic movie. Fans berate Shaq over hypocritical take on the next guard. Well, that's the title of it. And this is where we in our community have to build strong networks in communication, strong networks in the grassroots, and tie them all together, because we got to call out even our own people. Although we love our people, sometimes we have to say, hey, look, we are the ones that have been more unjustly murdered in the street where nobody goes to jail. I mean, people talk about the Jewish community and anti-Semitism. Well, what about when black people get murdered and nobody goes to jail? George Zimmerman is not only not in jail, but George Zimmerman is out and about signing books and signing autographs and rebel flags. See, we have to have a strong organization to be able to combat stuff like that, to let people know you don't just get away with murdering our people.
That's right. All right. All right, well, which theater? What city? What state?
Okay, let me see. The Hypocritical Guard, because I haven't read the whole article. I saw on the wrong side years ago. I saw that, and instead said stating that I'm going through the article right now, and they talked about how, and Charles Barkley, who also, which is pitiful, probably never even seen the movie, but they were saying that it's called a hypocrite. And so far, it had in the article, it hasn't shown the city or the state.
Yeah, that's why I'm not asked, because, yeah. So we got to check that out just to be sure to verify it, because I thought that was pretty interesting that they
okay,
didn't
I'm,
miss
I'm
the...
Okay, I'm sorry. In one of the comments that somebody posted, it's in Cityplex 12 in New Jersey.
Oh, man, I got to ask Sister Manera then, because she's in Newark.
Because Larry,
okay.
It was posted by Larry Legend. I'm sorry. Yeah, Larry Legend posted it where it was. It didn't say it in the article from what I saw, because I went through the article. It didn't say it in the article, but Larry
right.
Legend posted that the theater is in Cityplex 12 in Newark, New Jersey. So in the same city that Kyrie Irving plays for the New Jersey Nets, is playing in New Jersey, according to this post.
Wow.
But now, if you notice, Stephen A. and several others have jumped on the other side in support of Kyrie Irving, because Kyrie Irving has to do these six steps, one of them being meet the Jewish rabbi, give $500,000, and meet with the owner of the Nets, and meet with the owner of the and meet with the NBA commissioner. Now there's a move to say that, hey, Kyrie Irving, that's too much for him when the man already apologized. But this is what our people have to look at. When people murder us, we're quick to forgive. But when we offend them, nobody wants to forgive, and it's never enough, and you can't apologize enough, as Nick Cannon found out. So what we have to do is we have to stop looking for apologies and start looking to organize our people.
Yeah. You know, I'm just so sick of these people. I really am. And I just, I hate the fact that this brother, you know, is going through this, is being sent through this, and also that he's being, you know, put in a position to be forced to apologize. I mean, apologize for what?
Yeah, for a tweet.
To just shut,
for a
yeah,
movie he didn't
this,
make.
But not only didn't make a movie that he didn't even tell people to, well, you know, go see it and all of that, you know. I mean, it's just ridiculous. And as others have talked about it over this past week, the fact that Amazon people, the owner and whomever, have not been cited, have not been attacked, clearly, this
yep.
is some chumped up stuff.
Well,
how
also,
do you attack somebody that talks about it, but you don't go to the people who actually distribute it?
The tweet came from Amazon. It was the tweet that Kyrie Irving posted was from Amazon. And also, a lot of people might not be aware of that there was some talks with Amazon partnering with the NBA to have a live streaming service for some of the NBA games, and the deal is supposed to be for $1.3 billion. So not only do you not talk about Amazon, you're going to partner with them in business for a live streaming service. See, these are the things that we have to ascertain and we have to look at. That not only are they making money, they look like they're going to make more money off of this while they're trying to condemn Kyrie Irving, as they already suspended him for 5 games. And now I hear that the suspension is indefinitely, meaning for a longer period of time.
Right.
And nobody's asking the New Jersey Nets to say, hey, what are you going to do without one of your star players? How are you planning on winning? But this may be backlash because, remember, last year he didn't want to get vaccinated.
Right. Point of clarity, Brother Adrian, it's New York, not Newark.
Okay.
He's in New York.
Okay.
And so the theater that you were referring to, that's Newark, New Jersey.
Okay.
Right? So one is Newark and the other one is New York.
Okay.
Right? So just a point of clarity on that. But Brother Adrian, stay right there. We got a caller with a question or a comment. Caller, you are at 9462. Your mic is open. Welcome to this segment of New Day.
Good evening. This is Elder Mama Condi. I'm going to be
greetings, Mama.
Hi, sweetie pie. How you doing?
I'm good. Yourself?
I'm still sucking in this. The brother that was talking about Baba Matulu, Dr. Love.
I think he got dropped off. He didn't get back on. No. I don't know if it was a. Yeah, I'm looking for him,
well,
but I'm not seeing him.
Hopefully he can hear this and maybe comment next time he is on the broadcast. I wanted to say I'm not surprised at what they're doing to Mutulu. It's par for the course. Remember I mentioned to you about the brother who they held.
Yeah.
He did his 30, and then they held him another 16, 17 years, and he's still there. And I thought it was important to say that because we need to understand and comprehend that it is possible for Mutulu to be paroled and still be sitting there. Veronica Bowers, that's his name. His name just came to me. Veronica Bowers. Veronica did 30, and they said, you're free, but they just didn't open the door. His family was on one side of the gate. He was on the other, and they had it all arranged where he would parole out to his sister, who is like a sheriff or something like that, perfect person to roll out to. And he's still sitting there to this very day.
Wow.
So it is very possible. Ravonza has a Black Panther Party, Black Ground, and some other revolutionary actions. And also he's politically and culturally conscious. And he still sits there to this very day. I just think we need to realize that, or they let it out so late, like they did, say, Kukan Bully. They let him out so late, he'll even live a year. This is the strategy that these crackers have, and we just need to be aware. Just keep fighting.
Thank you, Mama Condi. So, needless to say, family, we've got to do better, and we've got to get free, for real. I mean, real freedom, that's just essential. And we're going to be talking more about what that means as we proceed. We cannot talk about just reparations. There's got to be a level of independence. For lack of a better word, we've got to do that. You know, again, the Mother Callie House was talking about ex-slave compensation / reparations, so we can't just be here today just talking about that. It's got to be some other things in this mix now, and so that's what we're looking to do. This is just too much, y'all, too much, but, you know, we've got to keep it moving. Needless to say, Brother Adrian, how's the weather there in Baton Rouge?
Yeah, the weather's terrible. It's been raining all day and it's cold. But I keep my head up anyway. It's gonna be sunshine anyway in my life because we got perspective to continue to match. And a lot of people are not aware that the issue of reparations is put in the war for. Like what Malcolm X is trying to do, it opens up so many other issues, not only about ownership of land, not only about cutting money, but also it opens up the conversation for the hypocrisy that America practiced, telling other countries how to treat their citizens, and it's shown that some of their citizens haven't been treated right. So it opens up a whole other layer, and that's why the importance of Dr. Mutulu Shakulu, a lot of people are not aware, he is the stepfather of Tupac Shakur. That's why Tupac was moving into the direction of getting black people to understand the need for freedom by talking about how they had millions of votes in their pocket with him and some of the artists. Tupac, Russell Simmons, and several others was working towards starting their own music distribution. And not long after that, Tupac was murdered. So we have to look at some of the independence that people were fighting on so many levels. And we have to continue to fight for independence on our level. That's why I appreciate yourself and the young lady who just called in, and Dr. Matula Shabazz, we have to fight for him, Momir, and several others to be able to get them out of prison so they can continue to fight for freedom, justice, and equality, and help in making black people equal on the world stage.
No doubt. And a point of clarity, not so much to make us equal, but to make sure we get our equal share of what it is that we're supposed to have. Next week, Brother Adrian, we're going to talk about another political prisoner that most don't know about, and his name is Rushel McGee. He's the longest held political prisoner now that we have. And, you know, he was with George Jackson the day that Jonathan Jackson was murdered. He was in the courtroom that day. And so next week we will be talking about, you know, what's going on with him. I think he might be 83 now, something like that. And again, you know, still incarcerated, right? So next week we'll be talking about him. This is just a horrific kind of situation. We've got to cite the human rights violations here. This is inhumane treatment. And we are the ones that have to now raise our voices about this. It can't just be about, you know, what the obvious is in terms of police and governmental terrorism that happens in our communities. We've got to start looking at some of these other things that are connected to the injustices of our people. It's just that simple. So, again, we're committed to doing that here at New Day. And, you know, we appreciate, you know, our family, extended family, and others who are also focused in that way. So listen, family, we are going to get ready to close out. We were just talking with Brother Adrian prior to Brother Adrian. We were talking with Mama Condi. And what I'd like to do now, let me just check to see if there's anyone that has any other questions or comments for us, because I'd like to share with you one of the there's so many speeches by Baba Kwame Ture, but this one is right on point because, you know, oftentimes I hear conversations talking about black. There's no nation called black or whatever. Well, guess what? Just getting ready to be, okay? Just getting ready to be. How about that? And what y'all going to say about that? But again, you know, the point is in defining our political dynamics, and this is why when we start doing these pre-plebiscite sessions, we're going to make it very clear that MWM and others, we are bringing forward what we call black internationalism. Now, y'all heard of black nationalism. Well, you get ready to hear about black internationalism now, because it's more than just in this country that we're talking about a certain mindset, a certain concept of thought, of political action, and so forth. And because there's often this debate or this competition with the idea of I'm a Nigerian, I'm a Gambian, I'm a Senegalese, I'm Jamaica, I'm African American. There's always these little, you know, these other kind of struggles with, you know, what we are in terms of nationality. And I mean, you know, I guess this is a human thing is going to be, but at the same time, we got to look at how we're going to flow in, around, and through some of that, you see. And so we're going to be introducing concepts that focuses on principles and modes of operations. Just like we talk about the Nguza Saba or the principles of Ma'a, well, we need to start looking at what is our political ideology, philosophy, methodology, and so forth. So we're going to be proposing to, at least we have a couple of them, by the way, but one of the things you're going to hear about is black internationalism. We'll tell you more about that next week. Brother Adrian, going to go to you for any closing comments that you have before I bring on the great Kwame Ture. 1967, y'all. But I want you to hear this very carefully, what he's saying, because you're going to think he was talking about yesterday or last week or something like that. But Brother Adrian, you got some closing comments for us.
Yeah, and speaking of Kwame Ture, he gave a good definition for Black Power. I just want to let everybody know that if you want to check me out, you can check out the Scotlandville Renaissance trailers by typing in the YouTube search bar, Brother Adrian, with an apostrophe S, open market. And you can check out the documentary that we're putting together trying to get black people to support black businesses to circulate economics in our community. And if you want to check out Update with the Community Defender with Brother Adrian, subscribe for free to www.emediagc.com. That's www.emediagc.com, or call 225-571-2274, 225-571-2274, email communitydefender@yahoohotmail.com, that's communitydefender@yahoohotmail.com. The Community Defender, we go to war. Empressy, thank you for the time, and thank you, guests and the elder.
All right, Ashe. So, family, as you can see, our network is growing with independent communications and media folks. Brother Adrian is in Baton Rouge. Of course, you heard earlier, Brother Ray Ray, Sister Keisha, they're all parts of our network. So every week we're going to be highlighting, you know, different extended family members so that we can keep this communication thing moving, growing, getting stronger, and definitely having more of an impact, bringing truth to power. All right, family, listen. I want to thank everyone. For those who are interested, tomorrow we will be doing our national, international Million Woman World March Zoom meeting. We have began the organizing. This is going to be something else. I'm telling y'all, don't be waiting for the last minute because it ain't going to work out for you. I'm letting you know that now. This is going to be incredible. Bringing black women, African women together from all over the world with the intention of not only unifying, but addressing and dealing with a lot of the issues and concerns that we talk about, but having our sisters to deal with some strategy sessions and modes of operations and so forth. I mean, you got to know that that's off the hook, as they say. Anyway. We'll be meeting tomorrow, 1:30 Eastern Time. Of course, the time will change in other places. Central Time, I believe, is an hour, but no, 3 hours difference. So for California, thereabouts, you're talking about 10:30, I believe it is, a.m. In Africa, it's 5 and 6 hours different ahead, so we're looking at 6:30, 5:30, 6:30 for them. So, again, you can email us at nationalmwm@aol.com. Again, nationalmwm@aol.com, and we will send you the link, or you can text us at 267-636-3802. Again, 267-636-3802. Again, that's tomorrow at 1:30 p.m. We're getting ready to start putting committees together on a national, international level for the Million Woman World March, which will take place next year. Going to be big, y'all. Anyway, we're going to now hear from Baba Kwame Ture. I want to remind everyone, again, please go to MatuluShakur.com, www.MatuluShakur.com. Please make your donation. Share it with your network. We got to do this. We got to make sure this brother gets home safely and is cared for in the way that he needs to be cared for. So that's it, family. Going to close out with, again, Kwame Ture.
The chairman and promote you in perpetuation. It's a special comment. much associated with the term black power, Mr. Carmichael defines it, black people coming together to form a political force and either electing representatives or forcing their representatives to speak their needs. Joining Mr. Carmichael today is H. Rep. Brown, the new chairman of SNCC. Mr. Carmichael has recently returned from the East Coast, where he participated in the anti-war demonstrations in New York. Following his talk, Mr. Carmichael will address himself to the questions that you have submitted in the boxes on the way into the pavilion. And now it is my pleasure to present Stokely Carmichael. Good afternoon. I was hoping to see Mr. Alcindor dunk one of his shots, but the white folk got together and stopped him from doing it. That's just a cutback in black power. We got a cutback. Wanted to read an article today which I wrote for the Massachusetts Quarterly entitled Towards Black Liberation. The article deals theoretically with black power as a concept, and then it outlines programmatically the implementation of that concept. It deals with the question of integration as it's practiced in this country and comes to the conclusion that integration is a subterfuge for the maintenance of white supremacy and dismisses integration as any real way for black people to have equality in this country. It further goes on to attack the coalition theorists and the people who are the major exponents of it, notably Mr. Byard Rustin, and his concept of coalitions. We want to state here that while we're not opposed to coalitions, we're opposed to coalitions at this time because we do not think that they will benefit black people anything. The paper then moves on to point out the difference between individual acts of racism and institutionalized racism, and the importance to black people of functioning, of turning their attention towards institutionalized racism. Now, I know that the press will be incapable of dealing with the article because it's on an intellectual level. As they were incapable of dealing with the conference for the survival of black people yesterday, and as they will be incapable of dealing with all other intellectual matters. But however, since you are a university crowd, we hope you will be able to deal with the paper on its intellectual level. One of the most pointed illustrations of the need for black power as a positive and redemptive force in a society degenerating into a form of totalitarianism is to be made by examining the history of distortion that the concept has received in national media of publicity. In this debate, as in everything else that affects our lives, black people are dependent on and at the discretion of forces and institutions within the white societies which have little interest in representing us honestly. Our experience with the national press has been that where they've managed to escape a meretricious special interest in get-righty sensationalism and race war mongering, individual reporters and commentators have been conditioned by the developing racism of the society to the point where they are incapable even of objective observation and reporting of racial incidents, much less the analysis of ideas. But this limitation of vision and perception is an inevitable consequence of the dictatorship of definition, interpretation, and consciousness, along with the censorship of history that the society has inflicted upon black people and consequently upon itself.
Our concern for black power addresses itself directly to this problem, the necessity for black people to reclaim our history and our identity from the cultural terrorism and depredation of self-justifying white guilt. To do this, we shall have to struggle for the right to create our own terms through which to define ourselves and our relationship to the society and to have these terms recognized. This is the first necessity of a free people and the first right that any oppressor must suspend. The white fathers of American racism knew this instinctively, it seems, as is dictated by the continuous record of distortion and omission in their dealings with the red and black men. Now, in SNCC, we feel that the importance of definition is uppermost in psychological warfare. As a matter of fact, Mr. Camus, on the very first page of The Rebel, points out that when a slave stops accepting the definitions imposed upon him by his master, then and only then does he begin to move towards his liberation. And that has been some of the problems that black people and other minorities have suffered in this country. We have been defined by white Western society. Note, I define it white Western society, never white Western civilization. That's a misnomer at best, a lie when you get right down to it. Yeah. And the important definition works very hard against us. Let me give you an example. You ever watch television? You see the red man and the white man are having a fight. And the red man is winning. So the white man sends for the cavalry. And the cavalry come out, and they're riding very white and very proper. And they get off their horses, and they blow their horns, and they get their guns, they load them up, and they shoot. And they ride back to the fort, and there's a white woman standing outside. She says, "What happened?" And a dashing lieutenant says, "We had a victory. We killed all the Indians." Now, when the reverse happens, when the red man wins the battle and beats up the white man, there's one left hanging on a horse, and he rides to the fort. She says, "Oh, what happened?" "Those dirty Indians, they massacred us, you know." And the importance of that is very important because a victory is not as honorable as is a massacre. And these poor red people will never win a victory because they'll always win a massacre. And the connotation of a massacre is something foul. I guess the difference is that in a victory, you're shot to death. In a massacre, you're cut to death. And if you would die, we want to be shot to death rather than cut to death. Another example of that would be today on television. You ever see the editorial twins of America, Huntley and Brinkley? They're always sitting in judgment of SNCC. If we ever judge them, they flunk. But anyway, they come on TV and they're talking about Vietnam. They say, "Today, filthy, dirty, communist, rebel, filthy, rebel forces threw Molotov cocktails and wounded 17 civilians." And there's a flash, you know. The next guy comes on. "In the meantime, our good GIs have been bombing the hell out of North Vietnam." Yeah. Okay. So that it is clearly a question of definitions, and it's crystal clear in our minds at SNCC that in this day and age, black people are going to define themselves as they see fit, use the terms that they want to use, and have their oppressors, white America, recognize those terms. We will not be defined or prescribed. In the same way that the Southern apologists for the Jim Crow society have so obscured, muddied, and misrepresented the record of the Reconstruction period until it is almost impossible to tell what really happened, their contemporary counterparts, the American press, is busy doing the same thing with the recent history of the civil rights movement. In 1964, for example, the National Democratic Party, led by Lyndon Buffoon Johnson, Now, we've called Lyndon a buffoon, and people got upset about it. See, they got upset because they didn't know what a buffoon is. A buffoon is a court jester, and his job is that when things are going bad in the kingdom, to tell everybody it's going okay, to lie to them, in essence. You know, have you ever seen him on TV when he talks about peace?
Every night before I go to bed, I ask myself, what have I done to preserve peace? Mom, go in. Well, anyway, in 1954, Lyndon B. Johnson and H.H. Humphrey, there's another one for you. In the black community, we call him Handkerchief Head Humphrey. Now, a handkerchief head is someone who is more obsequious and more unctuous than an Uncle Tom. He is an unconditional yes man. Did you dig back in January or February when Lyndon Johnson was preparing his State of the Johnson message to the Union? It had to be that. Well, if you notice, the cameras were focused on Lyndon, and Handkerchief Head was right in the background. And everything Lyndon said, he developed frog-like features every time Johnson says jump. He says, how high, boss man? Well, anyway, in 1964, these two cats, LBJ and HHH, cynically undermined the efforts of Mississippi's black population to achieve some degree of political representation. I'm speaking now of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party challenge that took place in Atlantic City, September 1964, at the National Democratic Party Convention. Yet, whenever the events of that convention are recalled by the press, one sees only that version fabricated by the press agents of the Democratic Party. A year later, we're speaking now about the challenge that the same party, the Democratic Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, took to the Congress and asked that the same law invoked against Mr. Powell be invoked against a racist Mississippi congressman. A year later, the House of Representatives, in an even more vulgar display of political racism, made a mockery of the political rights of Mississippi's blacks when it failed to unseat the Mississippi delegation to the House, which had been elected through a process which had systematically excluded over 450,000 voting age blacks, almost one half of the total electorate of that state. A year later, the same House was able to do the same thing to Representative and my congressman in exile, Adam Clayton Powell, because he does the same thing that they do, but with more style. Whenever this event is mentioned in print, it is in terms which leaves one with the rather curious impression that somehow the oppressed black people of Mississippi are at fault for confronting the Congress with the situation in which they had no alternative but to endorse Mississippi's racist political practices. I mention these two examples because, having been directly involved in them, I can see very clearly the discrepancies between what happened and the versions that are finding their way into general acceptance as a kind of popular mythology. Thus, the victimization of black people takes place in two phases in this country. First, it occurs in fact and deed, and then, and this is equally sinister, it occurs in the recording of those facts and deeds. The Black Power Program and concept, which is being articulated by the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the Congress of Racial Equality, and a host of community organizations in the ghettos of the North and South, has not escaped that process. The white press has been busy articulating their own analyses, their own interpretations, and criticisms of their own creations. For example, while the press has given wide and sensational dissemations to attacks made by figures in the civil rights movement, foremost among which are Ms. Roy Wilkins of the National Association of the Advancement of Colored People and his counterpart, Mr. Whitney Young of the Urban League, and to the hysterical rantings about black racism made by the political chameleon that now serves as a vice president, it has generally failed to give accounts of the reasonable and productive dialogue which has taken place in the black community and in certain important white religious and in intellectual communities. A national committee of influential black churchmen affiliated with the National Council of Churches, despite their obvious respectability and responsibility, had to resort to a paid advertisement to articulate their position, while anyone shouting the hysterical yappings of black racism got ample space. But the American people have gotten at best a superficial and misleading account of the very terms and tenor of this debate. Now, I'm going to read a quote to you from an advertisement which was taken out in the New York Times July 31 of last year. It was signed by about 150 black churchmen from across the country. I want to read it at length because I don't think people get a chance to hear the very important dialogue that goes on within the black community. They just hear where white people decide who the extremists are, and they let them hear who the extremists are. I quote, "We, an informal group of Negro churchmen in America, are deeply disturbed about the crisis brought upon our country by historic distortions and important truths to Sunny California. Yeah. I'm going back to Georgia. All right, y'all got Regan, I got Maddox. The only difference is Maddox got a bigger head and he can swim with Humphrey. "We, an informal group of Negro churchmen in America, are deeply disturbed about the crisis brought upon our country by historic distortions of important human realities in the controversy about black power. What we see shining through the variety of rhetoric is not anything new, but the same old problem of power and race which has faced our beloved country since 1619. The conscience of black men is corrupted because having no power to implement the demands of conscience, the concern for justice in the absence of justice becomes a chaotic self-surrender. Powerlessness breeds a race of beggars. We are faced now with a situation where powerless conscience meets conscienceless power." I would like to repeat that phrase because I think it is axiomatic to race relations in the country today. We are faced now with a situation where powerless conscience meets conscienceless power, threatening the very foundation of our nation. We deplore the overt violence of riots, but we feel it is more important to focus on the real sources of these eruptions. These sources may be embedded inside the ghetto, but the basic cause lies in the silent and covert violence which white middle-class America inflicts upon the victims of the inner city. In short, the failure of American leaders to use American power to create equal opportunity in life as well as law, this is the real problem and not the anguish cry of black power. America has, without the capacity to participate with power, that is to have some organized political and economic strength to really influence people with whom one interacts, integration is not meaningful. America has asked its Negro citizens to fight for opportunity as individuals, whereas at certain points in our history, what we have needed most has been opportunity for the whole group, not just for selected and approved Negroes. We must not apologize for the existence of this form of group power. All right, CIA, you keep it up. For we have been oppressed as a group and not as individuals. We will not find our way out of that oppression until both we and America accept the need for Negro Americans as well as for Jews, Italians, Poles, and white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, among others, to have and to wield group power. End of quote. Traditionally, for each new ethnic group, the route to social and political integration into America's pluralistic society has been through the organization of their own institutions with which to represent their communal needs within the larger society. Simply stated, this is what the advocates of black power are saying. The strident outcry, particularly from the liberal community that has been evoked by this proposal, can only be understood by examining the historic relationship between black people and white power in this country. Blacks are defined by two forces, our blackness and our powerlessness. There have been traditionally two communities in America, the white community, which controls and defines the forms that all institutions within the society would take, and the black community, which has been excluded from participation in the power decisions that shape society and has traditionally been dependent upon and subservient to the white community. This has not been accidental. The history of every institution of this society indicates that a major concern in the ordering and structuring of the society has been the maintaining of the black community in its condition of dependence and oppression. This has not been on the level of individual acts of discrimination between individual whites against individual blacks, but as total acts by the white community against the black community. This fact cannot be too strongly emphasized, that racist assumptions of white superiority have been so deeply ingrained in the structure of the society that it infuses its entire functioning and is so much a part of the national subconscious that it is taken for granted, frequently not even recognized. Let me give an example of the difference between individual acts of racism and institutionalized racism and the society's response to both. When unidentified white punkies bomb a black church and kill five black children, that is an act of individual racism, widely deplored by most segments of the society, white and black. But when in that same city, Birmingham, Alabama, not five, but 500 black babies die each year because of lack of proper food, shelter, and medical facilities, and thousands more are maimed physically, emotionally, and intellectually because of conditions of poverty and deprivation in the ghetto, that is a function of institutionalized racism. That's important. We're going to take care of individual acts of racism from this day on. But the society either pretends it doesn't know of this situation or is incapable of doing anything meaningful about it. And this resistance to doing anything meaningful about conditions in the ghetto comes from the fact that the ghetto is itself a product of a combination of forces and special interests inside the white community and the groups that have access to the resources and power to change that situation benefits politically and economically from the existence of the ghetto. It is more than a figure of speech to say then that the black community in America is the victim of white imperialism and colonial exploitation. This is in practical economic and political terms true. For philosophy students, it would be called a truism. There are over 20 million black people comprising 10% of this nation. For the most part, we live in well-defined areas of the country, in the shanty towns and rural black belt areas of the South, and increasingly in the slums of northern and western industrial cities. If one goes into any black community, whether it be Jackson, Mississippi, Cambridge, Maryland, or Watts in Los Angeles, one will find that the same combination of political, economic, and social forces are at work. The people in the black community do not control the resources of that community, its political decisions, its law enforcement, its housing standards, even the physical ownership of the land, houses, and stores lie outside that community. It is white power that makes the laws, and it is violent white power in the form of armed white cops that enforces those laws with guns and nightsticks.